Riding the buses no longer looked dull and jaundiced, but glowed and shone with a new light. When I looked into the mirror, my eyes sparkled like diamonds. My body had become like a feather, and I could work all day without tiring or feeling a need to sleep. One morning a colleague of mine in the office stared at my face and then exclaimed with a note of wonderment in her voice,
"What's going on, Ferdows?"
"Why?" I inquired.
"Your face is not the same."
"What do you mean, not the same?"
"It's as though it's radiating some inner glow."
"I'm in love."
"In love?"
"Do you know what it is to love?" I asked her.
"No,"
she said sadly. "You poor thing," said I.
"You poor deluded woman," said she. "Do you believe there is any such thing as love?"
"Love has made me a different person. It has made the world beautiful." There was a deep note of sadness in her voice as she spoke.
"You're living an illusion. Do you believe the words of love they whisper in the ears of penniless women like us?"
"But he's a revolutionary. He's fighting for us and for all those who are deprived of a decent life."
"You really are to be pitied. Do you think what they say in their meetings is true?"
"That's enough," I said angrily. "You wear dark glasses over your eyes and then say you cannot see the sunshine." The sun was on my face. I gazed at the light and warmth around me, basking in it with wonder as I watched him cross the courtyard at the usual hour. His eyes sparkled in the sunshine with a strange new brilliance. They looked different to me, like the eyes of another man, and I felt estranged. I ran up to him, but there was a group of employees gathered around him, men and women, shaking his hands and congratulating him. He did not see me in the crowd. I heard words that rang in my ears with a strange resonance.
"He got engaged to the chairman's daughter yesterday. He's a clever lad, and deserves whatever good fortune may come to him. He has a bright future to look forward to and will rise quickly in the company."
I put my hands over my ears to shut out the sound of their voices. I walked away from the happy throng around him and left through the company gate, but did not go home. I walked round and round in the streets. My eyes could see nothing, for the tears kept flowing from them, drying up now and then for a short while, only to start flowing once more. When night fell, I was completely exhausted. All of a sudden, my tears ceased to flow, as though something had closed up inside. Soon my face and neck became dry, but the front of my bodice was soaking wet. The cold night air penetrated to my body. I shivered and wound my arms around my chest to try and keep warm. I remembered his arms around me and shivered even more. I wept, but the tears had dried once and for all. I heard a sound like that of a woman sobbing, and realized that the voice I could hear was mine. That night I went back to the company premises. I went into my office, collected my papers, put them in a small bag, and then walked to the main door. Since I heard the news in the morning, I had not seen Ibrahim again. I hesitated at the entrance for a moment and looked around slowly. My eyes wandered to the little garden in the backyard. I walked towards it and sat down. I kept looking around me all the time. Whenever I heard a sound coming from a distance or sensed some movement or other, I strained my ears and my eyes. I saw a shape about the size of a human body moving near the entrance to the courtyard. I jumped to my feet. My heart beat wildly. The blood started pounding through my chest, up to my head. It seemed to me that the shape was moving towards me. I felt myself walking to meet it. My body was bathed in sweat. My head and the palms of my hands felt wet. A twinge of fear went through me as I moved across the dark courtyard. I called out in a voice so faint that it fell short of my ears, "Ibrahim?" But the silence remained as deep as before. I became even more frightened, for I could still see what looked like a human shape in the night. I called out again, this time in a loud voice that I could now hear. "Who's there?" It was as if the loud voice dispelled the dream, like someone talking in his sleep as awakened by the sound of his own voice. The darkness lifted to reveal a brick wall which had been built in front of the entrance to the courtyard. It was a low wall, the height of an average man, built of bare bricks, without any plaster. Although I had seen it before, it seemed to have sprung up in front of my eyes at that very moment. Before I went out through the gate, I looked around me once more. My eyes swept the windows, the doors, and the walls, searching for something to open suddenly and reveal his eyes for a moment, or his hand waving the usual farewell. My eyes kept moving restlessly. At every moment I would lose all hope, only to regain it a moment later. My eyes would resume their frenzied search, and my breast would heave up and down more deeply. Before stepping out into the street, I paused for a last moment, standing motionless in the dark. Even as I walked down the street, I continued to turn round as though expecting something to happen, but the windows and doors remained as tightly shut as before. I had never experienced suffering such as this, never felt a deeper pain. When I was selling my body to men, the pain had been much less. It was imaginary rather than real. As a prostitute, I was not myself. My feelings did not arise from within me. They were not really mine. Nothing could really hurt me and make me suffer than the way I was suffering now. Never had I felt so humiliated as I felt this time. Perhaps as a prostitute, I had known so deep a humiliation that nothing really counted. When the street becomes your life, you no longer expect anything, hope for anything. But I expected something from love. With love, I began to imagine that I had become a human being. When I was a prostitute, I never gave anything for nothing, but always took something in return. But in love, I gave my body and my soul, my mind, and all the effort I could muster freely. I never asked for anything, gave everything I had, abandoned myself totally, dropped all my weapons, lowered all my defences, and bared my flesh. But when I was a prostitute, I protected myself, fought back at every moment, was never off guard. To protect my deeper inner self from men, I offered them only an outer shell. I kept my heart and soul, and let my body play its role, its passive, inert, unfeeling role. I learnt to resist by being passive, to keep myself whole by offering nothing, to live by withdrawing to a world of my own. In other words, I was telling the man he could have my body, he could have a dead body, but he would never be able to make me react, or tremble, or feel either pleasure or pain. I made no effort, expended no energy, gave no affection, provided no thought. I was therefore never tired or exhausted. But in love, I gave all. My capabilities, my efforts, my feelings, my deepest emotions. Like a saint, I gave everything I had without ever counting the cost. I wanted nothing, nothing at all, except perhaps one thing. To be saved through love, from it all. To find myself again, to recover the self I had lost. To become a human being who was not looked upon with scorn or despised, but respected and cherished and made to feel whole. I was not destined to achieve what I had hoped for. For no matter how hard I tried or what sacrifices I made, like some dreamer sold to a cause, I still remained a poor, insignificant employee. My virtue, like the virtue of all those who are poor, could never be considered a quality or an asset, but rather was looked upon as a kind of stupidity or simple-mindedness, to be despised even more than depravity or vice. The time had come for me to shed the last grain of virtue, the last drop of sanctity in my blood. Now I was aware of the reality, of the truth. Now I knew what I wanted. Now there was no room for illusions. A successful prostitute is better than a misled saint. All women are victims of deception. Men impose deception on women and punish them for being deceived, force them down to the lowest level and punish them for falling so low, bind them in marriage and then chastise them with menial service for life or insults or blows. Now I realized that the least deluded of all women was the prostitute, that marriage was the system built on the most cruel suffering for women. It was midnight and the streets were quiet. A gentle breeze was beckoning softly from the Nile. I walked along, enjoying the peace of the night. I no longer felt any pain. Everything around seemed to fill me with tranquility, the gentle breeze caressing my face, the empty streets, and the rows of closed windows and doors, the feeling of being rejected by people and at the same time being able to reject them, the estrangement from everything, even the earth and the sky and the trees. I was like a woman walking through an enchanted world to which she does not belong. She is free to do what she wants, and free not to do it. She experiences the rare pleasure of having no ties with anyone, of having broken with everything, of having cut all relations with the world around her, of being completely independent and living her independence completely, of enjoying freedom from any subjection to a man, to marriage, or to love, of being divorced from all limitations, whether rooted in rules and laws in time or in the universe. If the first man who comes along does not want her, she will have the next, or the one after. No need to wait any longer for just one man. No need to be sad when he does not turn up, or to expect anything and suffer when one's hopes are raised to the ground. She no longer hopes for anything, or desires anything. She no longer fears anything, for everything which can hurt her, she has already undergone. My arms opened wide to embrace the night, and my voice started to hum a song I vaguely remembered having heard before. I hope for nothing, I want for nothing, I fear nothing, I am free. A magnificent long-bonneted car pulled up in front of me. When the man looked out of the window, I laughed. In the soft, luxurious bed, I turned over from one side to the other, but neither made any effort nor experienced any pleasure or pain. As I turned over in the bed, a thought flashed through my mind. Revolutionary men with principles were not really different from the rest. They used their cleverness to get, in return for principles, what other men buy with their money. Revolution for them is like sex for us, something to be abused, something to be sold. I met Ibrahim by accident 4 years after he married. He wanted to come with me to my flat. I had not yet got over my love for him, so I refused. I would not prostitute myself with him. But several years after that, I gave in to his insistence and agreed to let him come to my place. He was on the point of leaving without making any gesture to show that he intended to pay me. I said, "You've forgotten to pay me." He took a £10 note out of his wallet with trembling fingers and gave it to me. "My rate is not less than £20, I explained, then added, "Sometimes it is even more." His hand started to tremble again as he extracted another £10 note from the wallet. I realized that he had not really been in love with me, but came to me every night only because he did not have to pay. I became aware of the fact that I hated men, but for long years had hidden this secret carefully. The men I hated most of all were those who tried to give me advice or told me that they wanted to rescue me from the life I was leading. I used to hate them more than the others because they thought they were better than I was and could help me change my life. They saw themselves in some kind of chivalrous role, a role they had failed to play under other circumstances. They wanted to feel noble and elevated by reminding me of the fact that I was low. They were saying to themselves, "See how wonderful I am. I'm trying to lift her out of the mud before it's too late, that slut of a woman." I refused to give them a chance to play this role. None of them was there to rescue me when I was married to a man who beat me up and kicked me every day, and not one of them came to my help when my heart was broken because I had dared to fall in love. A woman's life is always miserable. A prostitute, however, is a little better off. I was able to convince myself that I had chosen this life of my own free will. The fact that I rejected their noble attempts to save me, my insistence on remaining a prostitute, proved to me this was my choice and that I had some freedom, at least the freedom to live in a situation better than that of other women. A prostitute always says yes, and then names her price. If she says no, she ceases to be a prostitute. I was not a prostitute in the full sense of the word, so from time to time I said no. As a result, my price kept going up. A man cannot stand being rejected by a woman because deep down inside he feels the rejection of himself. No one can stand this double rejection. And so every time I said no, the man would insist. No matter how high I raised the price, he could not stand being refused by a woman. I became a very successful prostitute. I was paid the highest price, and even men of great importance competed for my favours. One day a very important personality from a foreign state heard about me. He arranged things in such a way that he could look me over without my noticing. Immediately after, he sent for me, but I refused to go. I knew that successful politicians cannot bear to accept defeat in front of others, probably because they always carry defeat within themselves. A human being cannot stand up to a double defeat. That is the secret of their continuous attempt to rise to power. They draw a feeling of supremacy from their power over others. It makes them feel victorious rather than defeated. It hides how essentially hollow they are inside, despite the impression of greatness they try to spread around them, which is all they really care for. My refusal made him even more intent on gaining a victory over me. Every day he would send me a man from the police, and each time this man would try a different approach. But I continued to refuse. Once he offered me money. On another occasion, he threatened me with prison. On still a third, he explained to me that refusing a head of state could be looked upon as an insult to a great man and lead to strained relations between the two countries. He added that if I really loved my country, if I was a patriot, I would go to him at once. So I told the man from the police that I knew nothing about patriotism, that my country had not only given me nothing, but had also taken away anything I might have had, including my honour and my dignity. I was surprised to see that the man from the police looked as though his moral pride was greatly shaken by what I had said. How could anyone be devoid of patriotic feeling? I felt like exploding with laughter at the ridiculous stance he was taking, the paradox he personified, his double moral standards. He wanted to take a prostitute to this important personality's bed, like any common pimp would do, and yet talk in dignified tones of patriotism and moral principles. But I realized that the man from the police was only obeying orders, and that any order issued to him was elevated to a sacred national duty. Whether he took me to prison or to an important man's bed, it was just the same to him. In both cases, he was fulfilling a sacred national duty. Where national duty was concerned, a prostitute could be awarded the highest honors, and murder could become an act of heroism. I refused to go to men of this sort. My body was my property alone, but the land of our country was theirs to own. On one occasion they put me in prison because I turned down one of these important men. So I hired a very big lawyer for a very big sum of money. Shortly after, I was released from jail without charges. The court decided I was an honourable woman. Now I had learnt that honour required large sums of money to protect it, but that large sums of money could not be obtained without losing one's honour. An infernal cycle whirling round and round, dragging me up and down with it. Yet not for a single moment did I have any doubts about my own integrity and honour as a woman. I knew that my profession had been invented by men, and that men were in control of both our worlds, the one on earth and the one in heaven. That men force women to sell their bodies at a price, and that the lowest paid body is that of a wife. All women are prostitutes of one kind or another. Because I was intelligent, I preferred to be a free prostitute, rather than an enslaved wife. Every time I gave my body, I charged the highest price. I could employ any number of servants to wash my clothes and clean my shoes, hire a lawyer, no matter how expensive, to defend my honour, pay a doctor for an abortion, buy a journalist to publish my picture and write something about me in the newspapers. Everybody has a price, and every profession is paid a salary. The more respectable the profession, the higher the salary, and a person's price goes up as he climbs the social ladder. One day, when I donated some money to a charitable association, the newspapers published pictures of me and sang my praises as the model of a citizen with a sense of civic responsibility. And so, from then on, whenever I needed a dose of honour or fame, I had only to draw some money from the bank. But male noses have an uncanny way of sniffing out money. And so, one day, a man came along and asked me to marry him. I refused. The imprint of my husband's shoe was still there on my body. Then came another one looking for love, but I refused him too. Deep down inside of me, there were still vestiges of the old pain. I thought I had escaped from men, but the man who came this time practiced a well-known male profession. He was a pimp. I thought I could buy him off with a sum of money, the way I did with the police. But he refused the money and insisted on sharing in my earnings.
Every prostitute has a pimp to protect her from the other pimps and from the police. That's what I'm going to do to you.
But I can protect myself, I said.
There isn't a woman on earth who can protect herself.
I don't want your protection.
You cannot do without protection, otherwise the profession exercised by husbands and pimps would die out.
I refuse your threats.
But I'm not threatening you. I'm just giving you a little advice.
And if I don't accept your advice?
Then I may be obliged to threaten.
How do you propose to threaten me?
I have my own ways of doing things. Every craft has its tools.
I went to the police, only to discover that he had better connections than I. Then I had recourse to legal proceedings. I found out that the law punishes women like me, but turns a blind eye to what men do. And this man, this pimp whose name was Marzouk, enjoyed a good laugh as he watched me from a distance, striving in vain to find some way of protecting myself from him. One day he saw me entering my house and followed me. I tried to shut the door in his face, but he took out a knife, threatened me with it, and forced his way in. "What do you want of me?" I asked.
"I want to protect you from other men,"
he replied. "But no one else besides you is menacing me."
"If it isn't me, it will be someone else. There are pimps running around everywhere. If you want me to marry you, I'm perfectly willing to do so."
"I don't see the need for you to marry me as well. It's enough that you take what I earn. My body, at least, is mine." He went on like a successful businessman.
"I'm in business. My capital is women's bodies, and I don't mix work and love together."
"Do you know anything about love?"
"Is there anyone who does not know what love is? Haven't you fallen in love at one time or another?"
"I have."
"And now?"
"It's over. There's nothing left. And you?"
"It hasn't died yet."
"Poor thing. How miserable you must be."
"I tried to get over it, but failed."
"Is it a man or a woman? Pimps usually prefer men."
"No, it's a woman."
"Do you keep her?"
"I'm giving her everything. My money, my mind, my body, my being, my energy, everything. And yet I feel that I do not satisfy her, that she's in love with another man."
"You poor thing."
"Everybody's the same when it comes to love."
He looked straight into my eyes and said,
"You're living an illusion. I can see in your eyes how love has broken the spirit that used to shine."
"Love makes the eyes sparkle, it does not kill their shine."
"You poor thing. You've never really known what it is to be in love. I'm going to teach you."
He tried to pull me to him, but I pushed him away and said, "I don't mix work with love."
"Who said this is love? It's just part of the job."
"Impossible."
"For me, the word impossible does not exist."
He wound his arms around me. I felt the familiar weight pressing down on my breast, but my body withdrew, turned in on itself away from me like some passive, lifeless thing, refusing to surrender, undefeated. Its passivity was a form of resistance, a strange ability, not to feel either pleasure or pain, not to let a single hair on my head or my body be moved. So he began to share in everything that I earned, in fact, to confiscate the larger part for himself. But each time he tried to come near me, I pushed him away, repeating, "It's impossible, it's no use trying." Then he'd beat me up, and each time I would hear the same phrase repeated as he struck me.
"The word does not exist for me."
I discovered he was a dangerous pimp who controlled a number of prostitutes, and I was one of them. He had friends everywhere, in every profession, and on whom he spent his money generously. He had a doctor friend to whom he had recourse if one of his prostitutes became pregnant and needed an abortion, a friend in the police who protected him from raids, a friend in the courts who used his legal knowledge and position to keep him out of trouble and release any of the prostitutes who found herself in jail so that she was not held up from earning money for too long. I realized I was not nearly as free as I had hitherto imagined myself to be. I was nothing but a body machine, working day and night so that a number of men, belonging to different professions, could become immensely rich at my expense. I was no longer even a mistress of the house for which I had paid with my efforts and sweat. One day I said to myself, "I can't go on like this." I packed my papers in a small bag and got ready to leave, but suddenly he appeared, standing in front of me.
"Where are you going?"
he asked. "I'm going to look for work. I still have my secondary school certificate."
"And who said that you were not working?"
"I want to choose the work I'm going to do."
"Who says anyone in this whole wide world chooses the work he wants to do?"
"I don't want to be anybody's slave."
"And who says there is anyone who's not someone else's slave? There are only two categories of people, Faridus, masters and slaves."
"In that case, I want to be one of the masters and not one of the slaves."
"How can you be one of the masters? A woman on her own cannot be a master, let alone a woman who's a prostitute. Can't you see you're asking for the impossible?"
"The word impossible does not exist for me," I said. I tried to slip through the door, but he pushed me back and shut it. I looked him in the eye and said, "I intend to leave." He stared back at me. I heard him mutter,
"You will never leave."
I continued to look straight at him without blinking. I knew I hated him as only a woman can hate a man, as only a slave can hate his master. I saw from the expression in his eyes that he feared me, as only a master can fear his slave, as only a man can fear a woman. But it lasted for only a second. Then the arrogant expression of the master, the aggressive look of the male who fears nothing, returned. I caught hold of the latch of the door to open it, but he lifted his arm up in the air and slapped me. I raised my hand even higher than he had done and brought it down violently on his face. The whites of his eyes went red. His hand started to reach for the knife he carried in his pocket, but my hand was quicker than his. I raised the knife and buried it deep in his neck, pulled it out of his neck and then thrust it deep into his chest, pulled it out of his chest and plunged it deep into his belly. I stuck the knife into almost every part of his body. I was astonished to find how easily my hand moved as I thrust the knife into his flesh and pulled it out almost without effort. My surprise was all the greater since I had never done what I was doing before. A question flashed through my mind. Why was it that I had never stabbed a man before? I realized that I had been afraid, and that the fear had been within me all the time, until the fleeting moment when I read fear in his eyes. I opened the door and walked down the stairs into the street. My body was as light as a feather, as though its weight had been nothing more than the accumulation of fear over the years. The night was silent. The darkness filled me with wonder, as though light had only been one illusion after another, dropping like veils over my eyes. The Nile had something almost magical about it. The air was fresh, invigorating. I walked down the street, my head held high to the heavens with the pride of having destroyed all masks to reveal what is hidden behind. My footsteps broke the silence with their steady, rhythmic beat on the pavement. They were neither fast, as though I was hurrying away from something in fear, nor were they slow. They were the footsteps of a woman who believed in herself, knew where she was going, and could see her goal. They were the footsteps of a woman wearing expensive leather shoes, with strong high heels, her feet arched in a feminine curve, rising up to full, rounded legs, with a smooth, taut skin and not a single hair. No one would have easily recognized me. I looked no different from respectable upper-class women. My hair had been done by a stylist who catered only for the rich. My lips were painted in the natural tone preferred by respectable women because it neither completely hides nor completely exposes their lust. My eyes were penciled in perfect lines drawn to suggest a seductive appeal or a provocative withdrawal. I looked no different from the wife of an upper-class government official occupying a high position of authority. But my firm, confident steps resounding on the pavement proved that I was nobody's wife. I crossed by a number of men working in the police force, but none of them realized who I was. Perhaps they thought I was a princess, or a queen, or a goddess. For who else would hold her head so high as she walked, and who else's footsteps could resound in this way as they struck the ground? They watched me as I passed by, and I kept my head high like a challenge to their lascivious eyes. I moved along as calm as ice, my steps beating down with a steady, unfaltering sound. For I knew that they stood there waiting for a woman like me to stumble, so that they could throw themselves on her like birds of prey. At the corner of the street I spotted a luxurious car, with the head of a man protruding from the window, its tongue almost hanging out. He opened the door of the car and said, "Come with me." I held back and said, "No."
"I will pay whatever you ask for."
"No," I repeated.
"Believe me, I will pay you anything you want."
"You cannot pay my price, it's very high."
"I can pay any price, I'm an Arab prince."
"And I'm a princess."
"I'll pay 1,000.
"No."
2,000, then."
I looked deep into his eyes. I could tell he was a prince or from the ruling family, for there was a lurking fear in their depths. 3,000, I said.
"I accept."
In the soft, luxurious bed, I closed my eyes and let my body slip away from me. It was still young and vigorous, strong enough to retreat, powerful enough to resist. I felt his body bearing down on my breast, heavy with long untold years of his life, swollen with stagnant sweat, a body full of flesh from years of eating beyond his needs, beyond his greed. With every movement he kept repeating the same stupid question,
"Do you feel pleasure?"
And I would close my eyes and say, "Yes." Each time he rejoiced like a happy fool and repeated his question with a gasping breath, and each time I gave the same answer, "Yes." With the passing moments, his foolishness grew, and with it his assurance that my repeated affirmations of pleasure were true. Every time I said yes, he beamed at me like an idiot, and an instant later, I could feel the weight of his body bear down on me more heavily than before. I could stand no more, and just when he was on the point of repeating the same stupid question again, I snapped out angrily, "No!" When he held out his hand with the money, I was still wildly angry with him. I snatched the notes from his hand and tore them up into little pieces with a pent-up fury. The feel of the notes under my fingers was the same as that of the first piastre ever held between them. The movement of my hands as I tore the money to pieces tore off the veil, the last remaining veil from before my eyes, to reveal the whole enigma which had puzzled me throughout, the true enigma of my life. I rediscovered the truth I had already discovered many years before when my father held out his hand to me with the first piastre he had ever given me. I returned to the money in my hand and with a redoubled fury tore the remaining banknotes into shreds. It was as though I was destroying all the money I had ever held, my father's piastre, my uncle's piastre, all the piastres I had ever known, and at the same time destroying all the men I had ever known, one after the other in a row, my uncle, my husband, my father, Marzu and Bayumi, Do'a, Ibrahim, and tearing them all to pieces one after the other, ridding myself of them once and for all, removing every trace their piastres had left on my fingers, tearing away the very flesh of my fingers to leave nothing but bone, ensuring that not a single vestige of these men would remain at all. His eyes opened wide in amazement as he watched me tear up the whole sheaf of banknotes. I heard him say,
"You are verily a princess. How did I not believe you right from the start?"
"I am not a princess," I said angrily.
"At first I thought you were a prostitute."
"I am not a prostitute. But right from my early days, my father, my uncle, my husband, all of them taught me to grow up as a prostitute." The prince laughed as he eyed me again and then said,
"You are not telling the truth. From your face I can see you are the daughter of a king."
"My father was no different from a king except for one thing."
"And what is that?"
"He never taught me to kill. He left me to learn it alone as I went through life."
"Did life teach you to kill?"
"Of course it did."
"And have you killed anybody yet?"
"Yes, I have." He stared at me for a brief moment, laughed, and then said,
"I can't believe that someone like you can kill."
"Why not?"
"Because you are too gentle."
"And who said that to kill does not require gentleness?" He looked into my eyes again, laughed, and said,
"I cannot believe that you are capable of killing anything, even a mosquito."
"I might not kill a mosquito, but I can kill a man." He stared at me once more, but this time only very quickly, then said,
"I do not believe it."
"How can I convince you that what I say is true?"
"I do not really know how you can do that."
So I lifted my hand high up above my head and landed it violently on his face. "Now you can believe that I have slapped you. Burying a knife in your neck is just as easy and requires exactly the same movement." This time, when he looked at me, his eyes were full of fear. I said, "Perhaps now you will believe that I am perfectly capable of killing you, for you are no better than an insect, and all you do is spend the thousands you take from your starving people on prostitutes." Before I had time to raise my hand high up in the air once more, he screamed in panic like a woman in trouble. He did not stop screaming until the police arrived on the scene. He said to the police,
"Don't let her go. She's a criminal, a killer."
And they asked me,
"Is what he says true?"
"I am a killer, but I've committed no crime. Like you, I kill only criminals."
"But he is a prince and a hero. He's not a criminal."
"For me, the feats of kings and princes are no more than crimes, for I do not see things the way you do."
"You are a criminal,"
they said.
"And your mother is a criminal."
"My mother was not a criminal. No woman can be a criminal. To be a criminal, one must be a man."
"Now look here, what is this that you are saying?"
"I am saying that you are criminals, all of you. The fathers, the uncles, the husbands, the pimps, the lawyers, the doctors, the journalists, and all men of all professions." They said,
"You are a savage and dangerous woman."
"I am speaking the truth, and truth is savage and dangerous." They put steel handcuffs around my wrists and led me off to prison. In prison, they kept me in a room where the windows and the doors were always shut. I knew why they were so afraid of me. I was the only woman who had torn the mask away and exposed the face of their ugly reality. They condemned me to death not because I had killed a man, there are thousands of people being killed every day, but because they are afraid to let me live. They know that as long as I am alive, they will not be safe, that I shall kill them. My life means their death. My death means their life. They want to live, and life for them means more crime, more plunder, unlimited booty. I have triumphed over both life and death because I no longer desire to live. Nor do I any longer fear to die. I want nothing. I hope for nothing. I fear nothing. Therefore, I am free. For during life it is our wants, our hopes, our fears that enslave us. The freedom I enjoy fills them with anger. They would like to discover that there is, after all, something which I desire or fear or hope for. Then they know they can enslave me once more. Some time ago, one of them came to me and said,
"There's hope for your release if you send an appeal to the President, asking him to pardon you for the crime you committed."
"But I don't want to be released," I said, "and I want no pardon for my crime. For what you call my crime was no crime."
"You killed a man."
"If I go out once again to the life which is yours, I will never stop killing. So what is the use of my sending an appeal to the President to be pardoned?"
"You criminal. You deserve to die."
"Everybody has to die. I prefer to die for a crime I have committed, rather than to die for one of the crimes which you have committed. Now I am waiting for them. After a little while they will come to take me away. Tomorrow morning I shall no longer be here. I will be in a place which no one knows. This journey to an unknown destination, to a place unknown to all those who live on this earth, be they king or prince or ruler, fills me with pride. All my life I was looking for something that would fill me with pride, something that would make me hold my head high, higher than the heads of everyone else, especially kings, princes, and rulers. Every time I picked up a newspaper with the picture of one of them in it, I would spit on it. I knew I was only spitting on a piece of newspaper, which I might need to spread on the shelves of my kitchen. Yet each time I used to spit and leave the spit to dry on its own. Anyone who saw me spitting at the picture might think that I knew the man whose face I was spitting at personally, but in fact I did not know him. For after all, I am only a lone woman, and one woman, no matter who she might be, cannot possibly know all the men who have their pictures published in the newspapers. Yes, no matter who she might be. I was no more than a successful prostitute, and no matter how successful a prostitute is, she cannot get to know all men. But with each of the men I ever knew, I was always overcome by a strong desire to lift my arm high up over my head and bring my hand smashing down on his face. Yet because I was afraid, I was never able to lift my hand. Fear made me see this movement as being something very difficult to carry out. I did not know how to get rid of this fear until the moment when I raised my hand for the first time. The movement of my hand upwards and then downwards destroyed my fear. I realized that it was an easy movement to execute, much easier than I ever thought it could be. Now my hand was no longer incapable of lifting itself high up in the air to land with violence on one of their faces. The movement of my hand had become very easy, and everything in my hand could be moved with a natural ease, even if it were a sharp knife which I thrust into a chest and then withdrew. It would penetrate in and come out with the natural ease of air entering the lungs and then flowing out. I am speaking the truth now without any difficulty. For the truth is always easy and simple, and in its simplicity lies a savage power. I only arrived at the savage, primitive truths of life after years of struggle, for it is only very rarely that people can arrive at the simple but awesome and powerful truths of life after only a few years. And to have arrived at the truth means that one no longer fears death. For death and truth are similar in that they both require great courage if one wishes to face them. And truth is like death in that it kills. When I killed, I did it with truth, not with a knife. That is why they are afraid and in a hurry to execute me. They do not fear my knife. It is my truth which frightens them. This fearful truth gives me great strength. It protects me from fearing death, or life, or hunger, or nakedness, or destruction. It is this fearful truth which prevents me from fearing the brutality of rulers and policemen. I spit with ease on their lying faces and words, on their lying newspapers.
Chapter 3
Ferodosa's voice suddenly fell silent, like a voice in a dream. I moved my body like someone moving in sleep. What lay under me was not a bed, but something solid like the ground, and cold like the ground, yet with a coldness which did not reach my body. It was the cold of the sea in a dream. I swam through its waters. I was naked and knew not how to swim, but I neither felt its cold nor drowned in its waters. Her voice was now silent, but its echo remained in my ears, like a faint, distant sound, like the voices one hears in a dream. They seem to come from afar, although they arise from close by, or seem to be nearby, although they come from afar. We do not know, in fact, from where they arise, from above or below, to our left or our right. We might even think they come from the depths of the earth, drop from the rooftops, or fall from the heavens. Or they might even flow from all directions, like air moving in space reaches our ears. But this was not air flowing into my ears. The woman sitting on the ground in front of me was a real woman. The voice filling my ears with its sound, echoing in the cell where the window and the door were tightly shut, was a real voice, and I was certainly awake. For suddenly the door was thrown open, revealing several armed policemen. They surrounded her in a circle, and I heard one of them say, "Let's go, your time has come." I saw her walk out with them. I never saw her again. But her voice continued to echo in my ears, vibrating in my head, in the cell, in the prison, in the streets, in the whole world, shaking everything, spreading fear wherever it went, the fear of the truth which kills, the power of truth, as savage and as simple and as awesome as death, yet as simple and as gentle as the child that has not yet learned to lie. And because the world was full of lies, she had to pay the price. I got into my little car, my eyes on the ground. Inside of me was a feeling of shame. I felt ashamed of myself, of my life, of my fears and my lies. The streets were full of people bustling around, of newspapers hanging on wooden stalls, their headlines crying out. At every step, wherever I went, I could see the lies, could follow hypocrisy bustling around. I rammed my foot down on the accelerator as though in a hurry to run over the world, to stamp it all out. But the next moment, I quickly lifted my foot and braked hard, and the car came to a halt. And at that moment, I realized that Ferodos had more courage than I.
That was Woman at Point Zero by Noel El-Saadawi, read by Laura Hanna.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.